Okay, so I guess this procession is one of the themes of the week here at the ITP. Since Bennett talked about it yesterday, I'm going to talk about it today, procession neutron stars, and Bennett's going to talk about it again tomorrow. So we'll all be real experts by the end of the week. So I think everybody here has studied wobble or torque-free precession as a freshman in physics. I know I did. I think everybody did. Just to remind you, my favorite example is that when you throw out, inexpertly throw an American football, which is the way I throw them. but I didn't have a football here. But just remind you that if you throw a football inexpertly, not only does it spin around its axis, but it tends to wobble a little. And you can see very easily the end of the football precess about the average, about the total angular momentum. And it looks kind of like this, right? If you imagine this spinning very fast, and it's going around, and that's wobble. Okay? And thing to know, and another example I think people read about often is in Feynman, the truly joking Mr. Feynman. He talks about how he got started again in electrodynamics when he saw a wobbling plate thrown, I guess at Cornell somewhere, and noticed that it was wobbling about twice as fast as it was spinning and worked out wobble equation. So I don't have a plate to throw, have you? I don't know. So you can ask, the wobble occurs in astronomical bodies. In fact, it occurs in the Earth. I think it's a fairly well-known fact that, in fact, the Earth wobbles a little bit in its spin. Torque-free precession is called the Chandler wobble. It's been known for something of order 100 years. Maybe you know better than I do. The amplitude is small, but sort of the, if this were imagined being sort of the North Pole of the Earth, it actually wobbles by about 10 meters on time scale. And nobody knows exactly what excites it, in fact. It's thought to be probably excited by earthquakes. Okay? And now a little bit of terminology. When I'm going to say that most things wobble just about the same. Things that are almost spherical, and everything I'm going to talk about is almost spherical, wobble at almost exactly the same rate as they spin. Okay? So that is in the inertial frame. So if this were sort of the North Pole of the Earth, I stuck this in the North Pole of the Earth, okay, it would actually then move around, actually, just about as fast as the Earth spins once a day. A little bit, it was a little bit faster, I guess. And that's the inertial frame precession frequency. The difference between that once a day and the rate at which it actually goes is called body frame precession frequency. And it has a period for the Earth of about 430 days. Okay? So things precess, almost everything you ever see precesses just about as fast as it, in the inertial frame, as it spins. If American football were almost spherical, that little end would go down just about as fast as it's spinning. Okay? Okay. And so there have been, in terms of neutron stars over the years, there have been maybe half a dozen examples of periodic modulations that people have thought maybe ascribable to neutron star wobble, and probably the strongest case was the one Bennett talked about yesterday. It's the PSO 1828 minus 11, which has a spin period of about half a second, 0.4 seconds, and perhaps wobbles with a period of about 500 days, which means that is to say that's the body frame wobble frequency. So it would actually be wobbling in inertial frame at almost exactly the spin period, differing from the spin period by one part in 10 to the 8th. Okay? That 10 to the 8th is 500 days divided by 0.4 seconds. Okay? Okay, now this brings me now to that's sort of the background. The question is, imagine you have a wobbling star like that. What kind of gravity wave does it emit, a neutron star? And also, more importantly for this talk, what do gravity wave back action do to the wobble? Okay? That's the problem. Now you understand the problem, I'm going to tell you now, it's the way I think about it, actually. It's just that it's a pretty almost textbook problem in general relativity. What's the gravitational radiation and the back reaction for a wobbling astronomical body, which may or may not have real relevance for astrophysics. Okay? Now I'm going to tell you a little story of how I got interested in this. You don't actually need me to know this story, but I think it actually helps you follow the chain of research a little bit. It's a little complicated, actually. Why did I think about this at all? Well, it was actually almost shoved at me in the sense that I was asked to be the external examiner on a PhD thesis by Ian Jones, who was here in this workshop. So maybe you know him. In his PhD thesis, well, lots of little claims, but actually one big claim, one big remarkable claim, which he was very proud of and was very excited about. So he claimed that actually gravitational radiation back reaction in some large fraction of cases actually drives an instability and makes wobble grow on a fairly short time scale. So he claimed to have found something very much like the Chandrasekhar-Friedman-Schultz instability for modes of neutron stars, but for wobble. And so he thought that he had shown that there should be quite a lot of wobbling stars, that they would grow. Okay, so that was given to me, and I was supposed to check it, basically. So that was the external examiner, I was probably the only one who was going to read this thesis. The internal examiner probably would not. Okay, so there was a kind of long calculation, and it was kind of hard to check. I just thought, look at the algebra. So I said, I can't do this, I can't check it all, but maybe I can redo it, because I just can't check it honestly. So I just closed the thesis, I hardly read it, and I just did it myself. Now, he had a fairly long way of doing it, but I thought about it a little bit, and I thought I actually came up with a much slicker way. So he had like 10 or 20 pages, and I came up with something like about a page or two, and I got exactly the different answer. So he had shown that in many cases it could be unstable and grow on a short time scale, and I found out that it was always stable, but damped on a long time scale. Okay.
So he got his master's.
Yeah, he ended up having so okay. So it turns out, so now let me tell you what Jones had done. Okay? So now that's what I had done. Let me tell what Jones had done up to this point. So a few years before, he was Bernie Schultz's graduate student. Bernie Schultz has for years sort of and giving review talks on general relativity that and neutron star wobble could be some source of gravity waves. But he never really done anything. So he assigned his student, Ian Jones, the task of saying if there's any physical, astrophysical mechanisms that might excite wobble. And he thought of lots and lots and lots of which, most of which didn't work. All of which didn't work. And until at some point actually he came upon a paper, a little known paper, this is another actor that comes into the story, by Bertotti. Many people know Bruno Bertotti, right? Bertotti and his student Anile, in 1973, had written a kind of beautiful and very little-known paper, actually working out this problem that is the subject of the talk today. What is gravitational wave back reaction on a wobbling neutron star? And they had found that gravity waves damp neutron star wobble incredibly efficiently for realistic neutron stars. And they give a formula. So, after the Ian had been working on this for like a year before he found this paper, and now he was very depressed because he found this huge damping mechanism. And he kept continuing working on it. And at some point, he dawned on him that if he looked at the formula, it wasn't actually always have the same sign. Sometimes it was plus and sometimes it was minus, depending on the various neutron star parameters. This is not said in Bertotti and Anile, but he said, oh my God, this is a short time scale, and it can be either sign. So he got very excited. Now the Bertotti and Neely paper, I looked at it later, is not very well written. It wasn't even clear whether some of the things were the actual things or the absolute values of the things. So well, he wasn't clear what the formula really meant. So really what his thesis did is he went through, I found out later, and he just redid every line, but carefully, and see if he got really the formula that they got without absolute values and things in them. And he really did. So he really got their formula, which is sometimes plus and sometimes minus in a short time scale. So he was really excited. Okay. So then I came up with this different calculation, and I was sure it was, and I just got a different answer, completely different answer. So, and this was like 2 weeks before he was supposed to defend his thesis. So I told him, you've made a mistake. I don't know what it is, but you made a mistake. And he said, no, I haven't. This is a great result. More or less. And I said, he said, check the algebra. I said, I didn't check the algebra, but I did it a different way, and I'm sure it's wrong. So I couldn't get him to do it, really, because he was sure it was right. Well, he just checked the algebra, so I had to do it. I mean, it was like a little like the election. It was like, I was thinking away. And we needed a definitive answer. And so I didn't want to really waste a lot of my time doing this, but it became kind of I had to take the bus a lot, actually, going to work. So it became my bus occupation to try to think of what was wrong with this calculation. I'll never forget, it was actually one of my best ideas last year. As I was stepping on the bus, I suddenly realized what they'd done wrong, you know, for tugging me away, you know, 28 years ago. And Ian Jones had made exactly the same mistake. And then I can go back and I can correct their, so I know I figured out how to correct their calculation, then I get exactly the same as mine. Okay, so the end result I'm going to tell you is that in realistic neutron stars, at least the kind we're going to consider, that the old calculation was wrong. I'm going to tell you the right answer. Okay?
Wait, what happened to this
poor graduate student? He had to redo his thesis, the whole thing. But he did graduate. It took 6 more months or something. Okay. Okay. Pardon?
You'll never anymore be invited.
I think I've done an excellent job.
I think that's what external examiners are supposed to do, otherwise why have them?
Yeah. Okay, so that was the story of why I got interested in this at all. Okay. Now back to physics, okay? So let me first tell you again a little about rigid body wobble, and then I'll tell you about wobble for a more realistic version of neutron stars. Okay? So this is, the first half of this is just a reminder again of things you learned and probably, if you're like me, forgot about from freshman physics, which is how rigid bodies wobble. So the picture, typically, you've got some angular momentum vector J, and let's actually take axisymmetric rigid bodies. I1 equal to I2, not equal to I3. And let's take the x3 axis just a little misaligned from J. Okay? And omega, well, it's then easy to show that omega and x3, the body axis, are all, and J are all coplanar. And the only thing that happens is these, basically x3 and omega, rotate around J rigidly at the wobble frequency, which you can work out. The wobble frequency, inertial frame wobble frequency, I'm going to call phi dot, which is just J over I1. Okay? And notice that while as theta goes to zero, as the wobble angle is, I'm going to call theta, the wobble angle by definition is the angle between the body axis and J. Even as the wobble angle goes to zero, these two frequencies are zero. They are different. Omega is the spin frequency. Phi dot is the wobble frequency, and even as the wobble tends to zero, there's a finite difference between these two. And for oblate bodies, where I3 is bigger than I1, things wobble a little faster than they spin. Like in Feynman's plate, it was twice as fast, in fact, because I3 is much bigger than I1. For prolate bodies, like the wobbling football, things wobble a little slower than they spin. Okay? I'll get back to these formulas actually at the bottom in a second. Okay, you can actually then ask what kind of gravity waves that puts out. And I for some reason, find it much easier to picture prolate bodies wobbling than oblate bodies wobbling, so I wrote down a prolate body, but it's the same idea. Okay, imagine this is a very prolate body that's spinning around this axis and then also wobbling like this. Okay, a little bit like a wobbling football. Okay? And this is the z-axis, x and y-axis. The dominant contribution of the gravity waves, what gravity waves are proportional to the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment, of the trace-free quadrupole moment. And the big piece I think you can see would be here the x, so these, I'm putting little balls here, where you can, I think you can see that it's the ixz and the iyz pieces that are periodic and changing, and are the biggest pieces that are changing. And they're changing, it's a little different from, say, mountain radiation, where the gravity waves come out at twice the spin frequency. The gravity waves come out exactly the wobble frequency. So IXZ returns to its original value only when this ball has gone all the way back to here. Okay, not when it's, when the thing is wobbled halfway, and it's like this, these are reversed. Go to negative sign. There's not the usual factor of two, you see. So it's so the gravity waves come out the wobble frequency, which in all astrophysical cases is very, very close to the spin frequency. Okay? A little bit higher than the spin frequency when it's oblate, a little bit lower than the spin frequency when it's prolate. Okay? And then you can just work it out what it is. These are these results. And the first people to work this out were Bertotti and Annealy, who did this part correctly. Okay? So they said their first model of a neutron star was, well, let's pretend it's absolutely rigid, an iron ball. It's as it can't be deformed at all. Okay? And then they took this classical mechanics problem and they just worked out what the time derivatives of the moments of inertia were. Okay? And they calculated very easily then from the quadruple formula the rate at which energy is going out. And they can then also calculate the damping rate, okay, of the wobble angle. And they get this number, which for particular values of delta I, where delta I is I3 minus I1, it's like a damping rate of 1 times 10 to the 6th years, 10 to the minus 7 divided by the oblateness, dimensional oblateness, kilohertz over the spin period to the 4th power for a typical value of a neutron star, moment of inertia. Okay? That's what they get. How did they get it? Well, I'll tell you their basic strategy. Here's how they did the calculation. So there's something that all relativists know, which is this Birkthorne radiation reaction potential. It's supposed to give you an extra piece of the gravitational potential due to the radiation rate, due to the radiation reaction piece of the gravity wave. Basically, it's you can add this into the Newtonian dynamics to figure out how the gravity wave pushes back on the body. Okay?
And you can use that as a local force.
And you can use that as a local force. That's right. I don't remember the year Burke and Thorne used it, but this must have been one of the first, in fact, applications of it. So this was actually pretty ahead of its time. It was pretty groundbreaking work, actually. So all they did, this Birkthorne radiation reaction potential, all you do is you take the fifth time derivative of the trace free quadruple moment, dot it twice into the position vector, and that's the Birkthorne potential times factor. Okay. And then that's just, you treat it then after that just like a Newtonian potential. You get the force, you take the green of the potential. Okay? And then to get the torque, you just dot, then if you just, torque is just R cross F, and if you integrate by parts, you can get this expression for the torque. Okay? That's just a simple three-line calculation I'm going to show you. But you get it by integrating by parts. So the torque is proportional, it's with an epsilon, of course, trace-free quadrupole moment times the fifth time derivative trace-free quadrupole moment. Okay? Great. So what did Bertotti and Annealy do? Absolutely fine. You probably remember that the way people figured out what precessional motion looks like in a rigid body is they write, I guess Euler was probably the first to do it, at least they're called Euler equations, right? With no torque, these are the Euler equations set equal to zero, okay? We put zeros here. They just calculated the torque and put it on the right-hand side. Okay, and from that, with a little bit of work, you can extract the secular change in the wobble angle. And we did it correctly and got the right answer. Great. Now I'll just remind you, this is the answer they got. That was correct. Okay. So that's rigid body precession and damping. Okay? Done correctly in 1973. Now but a neutron star is not a rigid body. It's hardly rigid, actually. So it does have, if it weren't rigid at all, if it were just liquid, it wouldn't precess at all. You get precession is effect because you have some finite rigidity in the crust. Okay? If we're just water sloshing, there'd be no such thing. But the crust isn't really completely, it's not a rigid, it's a solid body. It's not a rigidly solid body, it's quite elastic. In fact, it's very jello-like. Okay? Because the solid crust, that is to say, for iron, say, iron in the room, the bulk modulus and the shear modulus are about the same. And it's about as hard to shear it as it is to compress it. A neutron star crust is very different because the thing that supplies the pressure is neutron or electron degeneracy pressure. And the thing that keeps it from shearing, the thing that supplies the shear modulus, is just Coulomb forces between the nuclei. Okay? So you think of a neutron star crust, even though it's solid, it's very much jello on the relevant scales. It's very easy to shear. Okay, so it's hardly solid. This is barely solid. Okay. Great, so that's the kind of body. So let's say as a model, let's just pretend, so actually a neutron star is a very complicated thing, of course. It's got liquid part, a solid part. It's got superfluids, which may or may not be pinned. For this problem, this is just following Bertotti anyway, let's forget the superfluid part. Let's forget for now that we can add it later, the liquid part, and just pretend the whole thing is just very weakly solid. It's slightly the elastic body, okay? That's going to be our model. And now let's look at the precession of elastic bodies. Okay, this is something probably most people have not seen in freshman physics. So it turns out to be almost as easy. And the first people who worked this out, as far as I know, at least the standard source is Monk and MacDonald, 1960. There's a book on geophysics of the Earth or something like that. You'll find this. And this is how, this is what I'm about to show you, is the standard treatment for how looking at Chandler wobble of the Earth. Okay, because the Earth's an elastic body, too. And then Pines and Shum in 72, when they looked at wobbling neutron stars, all they did is they took the Earth model and they just translated it to neutron stars. Okay, then this is what they did. So this is what you do is you take, so we have some neutron star, okay? And you write it, its moment of inertia, and oh. So you write its moment as an inertia. It's supposed to be an I naught times a delta AB, a spherically symmetric piece. I'm sorry. Okay. So it's got some spherically symmetric piece plus two distortions for a rotating, wobbling neutron star. It's got one distortion that's just centrifugal. Okay. Only is the spin axis. It'll want to be oblated on the spin axis just by centrifugal force. Okay. And this delta omega will obviously be proportional to the spin frequency squared. Okay? And it'll have some piece around some other axis, which are some deformation axis and some body axis. Okay? Now, how does this come about? And how big is this? Okay? And what is this? So actually, just take this formula for a second, and then look at this picture. You can figure out what the ratio of these two angles is. To get J, you dot omega into I, okay? And then it's just two lines of calculation to show that theta, again, the angle between N and J is the wobble angle, and there's another angle, theta hat, between omega and J. And the ratio of theta hat over theta is just this deformation piece, okay, delta ID over I naught, two-thirds over I naught plus two-thirds delta I omega. Okay? I'm about to tell you that delta ID is really small over delta omega. So in all realistic cases, well, theta hat is much smaller than theta. Okay? So this picture is not so accurate. So omega is almost aligned with J, really. And N is much farther off. I just drew it this way so you could see it. So you could see the definitions. Okay? J and omega are almost aligned, and the body axis is wobbling at some wobble angle around it. Okay, so what's delta ID? Okay, this is something to explain. Okay? Here's the way I like to think about it. Delta ID is the residual oblateness, or the residual prolateness, the residual deformation the body has when it's no longer spinning. So this is the piece that's due to spin, by definition. And this is the piece that it would have, the deformation it would have if it's not spinning.
Go ahead. So you're assuming that the obliteness due to rotation has some symmetry along the instantaneous angle.
That's right.
And yet this thing's recessing at a frequency that's comparable to the rotation, the spin frequency.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm glad you asked that. Can I finish this and then I'll answer that question?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll answer that question in just a minute. Okay. That is confusing. Okay. Let me tell you first how to estimate the size of this term. Okay? So I think of this as the residual oblate, again, it's the residual oblateness a neutron star would have if you somehow could spin it down to zero without having the crust crack. Take the crab, okay? And the crab, let us say, is the strain in the crust now is pretty small. We know the crab glitches because it's slowing down. But if you stopped it slowing down and let it glitch a couple more times, it'd have to go to some strain-free shape, okay, which is oblate. Okay, of course. So the crust at the moment of the crab likes to be oblate. Right? Now imagine putting your hands on it and slowly letting it slow down till it was had zero angular velocity. Would it be spherical, a crab? No. The crust wants to be oblate. The fact that you're forcing it to be almost spherical by taking away the centrifugal force will set up little strains. It'll end up being a little bit oblate. So even because the crust wants to be oblate at the moment, if I slowed it down, it would still end up being a little oblate. Okay?
What's the symmetry the axis of symmetry about which
it wants to be oblate? The direction about which it was spinning.
So I don't understand. You say if you take away the spin, the oblateness that, you know, is due to the spin axis.
Yeah. There's still a little bit of oblateness left.
So it's always a little bit more oblate than
the equilibrium. Than a sphere, yeah. Take the Earth.
Without a crack.
It has some, without a cracking.
I see. So that's
and that's what that delta ID is in that equation. If I don't let it crack. Okay? And what is this residual oblateness for a neutron star? Well, it's not very big. The claim is, if you stop the crab, it would be a little oblate, but not nearly as oblate as it is now. So it would end up having, the residual oblateness would be about 10 to the minus 5th of what it started out to be. And 10 to the minus 5th is a small number, again, because the neutrons are so jello-y, the crust.
So the initial one you take, milliseconds or
well, no, it's what it is.
Oh, this is really for a crab. Okay.
No, or for any whatever neutrons that we're talking about.
Okay.
So you tell me the star, and then you tell me it's in equilibrium. Like say 1937 plus 21. If I had a different example, then delta I omega would be of the order of say 0.1. It's pretty oblate, presumably, times I naught. And delta ID would be 10 to the minus 5 smaller.
Okay, at that moment.
Okay?
So if I set that to 0, I should be going back to the previous case.
I don't understand the question.
If I set delta ID to 0, then the oblateness, I just fix the oblateness, and then I'm solving the exact same problem that you were just describing.
No, then you have a follow-up.
I'd still have the delta I omega.
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
So
here's the picture. Maybe say a few more words that'll help you, okay? So now take the crab again, okay? And imagine someone comes and gives it a little kick, okay? So the claim is you have a little kick. J is no longer aligned with omega, okay? If you give it a little kick, J will no longer be aligned with omega. The star will try to readjust itself so that its moment of inertia is along the new spin frequency. But it remembers a little bit that it used to be spinning around a different direction. So the stresses will be set up in the crust that force it to be a little oblate around this old direction. Okay? And so you'll end up having, so the thing, the piece that was the North Pole will still have a little oblateness around it. And it'll be small, but it'll be non-zero.
Why would it have anything to do with its current spin rate? Why is it not an absolute number? That's what I quite understand.
Because I think the way it's said occurred is the current strain level. I think the current strain level is set by your rotation. Is that?
It's another way of.
So I guess if people ask why is delta ID proportional to delta I omega? Why can't I have delta ID?
Well, no, it can't be arbitrarily large, but why is the maximum not a number rather than proportionality?
Just where did you get that? You know, 10 minus 5 delta.
That's a different, those are two different questions. Yeah. Let's see, so let me answer yours first. Okay, that's an easier one. I'll think about the other one I'm talking. So that's an easy question. That's a question you can ask about the neutron star. It's basically some ratio of Coulomb energy to neutron and the degeneracy energy, something like that. And you can just ask yourself for the Earth or for a neutron star, stop it spinning, what's the residual brightness? And the answer is it's small. Smaller than the original brightness by a factor of about 100,000 for a neutron star. Okay? And for this other question, yeah.
Can I say that differently, maybe just to
raise you? Yeah, go ahead, please.
That's the fraction that's the fraction by which this star isn't exactly as ablated as it should be if it were a liquid. So that's the correction to the ablateness due to the fact that there's a finite Schirmer.
That's right.
Why is it proportional?
Well, then for that statement, it has to be proportional. It's just the fractional bit.
Yeah, but okay. I don't see why it would be fractional rather than an absolute number, which just depends on the strength.
Well, let me say it in sort of an evocative way. So there's, I'm claiming there's an extra axis,
mm-hmm.
and there's a memory that is trying to be ablated on that axis, and it remembers it better the more ablated it was to begin with.
So, for example, if you had no spin, there would be no delta ID.
Right.
And in order to excite delta ID, you have to spin it up, allow this crust to crack
right.
into this new equilibrium, and then slow it down and let it
spin. You could ask, is it sort of a step function where you crack it up and then it
does not
fit.
Example, then if you start with a non-spinning neutron star, you suddenly spin it up, it will remember that it was spherical.
I knew this might be hard to explain. If I took a non-spinning neutron star and I spun it up without letting the crust crack, I claim it doesn't process.
Because
it remembers that there's no axis that it remembers.
Yes, I see.
Delta ID is zero.
That's
I should say, I have told you the way I've described how delta ID comes about is only one of two possibilities, but I think it's by far the more common. I mean, you can also just build a delta ID. You can go ahead and build a mountain on a neutron star, and then it'll have some delta ID also. I just think in most realistic cases, the ones I think about for gravity waves, the way you have it is that the thing relaxes to some oblate state. Okay? And then it remembers that to some extent. And the more ablated it is, the more it remembers it. Okay? And then you asked a different question, didn't you? Yeah. What was that question? Say it again.
The question was, why is the rotational contribution
right
about the instantaneous spin?
Right. I know. Here, I know.
Told us how well you interrogated your student.
That's fine. I got my PhD. Okay. So it's not exactly true. It's an approximation. It's certainly not exactly true. But the way to think about it, to make it sort of feel in your bones that it probably is true, is to go to the body frame. Okay? So in the body frame, you've got, say you're sitting here at the North Pole N. Okay. In the body frame, this omega is going around you slowly. As you see it, if you're sitting at the North Pole, it seems to you, from far away, it's going around pretty fast. It's going around some fixed position. But around you, it's going pretty slowly. So
400 days versus 1 day.
Yeah, that's right. 430 days versus 1 day. So what you see in, like sitting at the North Pole of the Earth, is the spin frequency is slowly moving around me. And of course the figure is trying to adjust. And it's got a lot of time. It's got so as it goes around me, so omen is like this, and first it'll be a little blader on this direction, and a little blader on this direction. But it's got a lot of time to adjust. So because the body frame precession frequency is slow, the fluid can adiabatically adjust so it has the right shape around the current omega. It won't be exactly true.
Okay, that sounds very plausible. Can I ask, you pointed out how subtle this problem is.
Yeah.
Did you actually solve the elastic structure of the neutron star when you were doing this calculation? I mean, you actually had elastic equations to calculate that moment of inertia self-consistently.
No.
No.
But,
okay.
No, I took. But the only fact I need, I claim, for this, assuming you have this. Assuming that I'm allowing things to adjust adiabatically, then the only thing I need is this factor, 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah.
That's the only number that comes in. And it will be a little different, actually, for some different equation of state if I solved it differently. But so I don't care if it's 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 6, actually, for this argument.
But do you think that adiabatic approximation is good to one part of the problem?
I don't think it has to be. I think if you see the way, there's a way of phrasing the argument for the damping rate that's pretty independent of that. So I don't, so no, it's probably not good to one part in 10 to the fifth. I don't think it has to be. I think it's more, I think the end result of the damping rate is a lot more robust than that. But I'm not sure, I'm pretty confident of that.
What is that factor for the Earth?
The Earth, it's a lot closer to one, but I can't remember what it is. I don't know. Do you remember? If I said 20% or 30%, it's not too far off. It remembers it a lot better. Maybe 50%. It's not one, though. Okay. Right. Okay.
Gravity isn't as strong as those.
And because the shear modulus is large, is not so small compared to the bulk modulus. If I stop the Earth from spinning, it will be really pretty oblate for a while. Okay. So for new, so, and then now, what's this ratio of theta hat to theta? Well, if you just do two lines of algebra, you find it's basically two-thirds delta ID over I zero. I'm going to write that as delta ID over delta I omega over I zero. And this thing is the 10 to the minus 5 again, roughly. And then this ends up being like 2 times 10 to the minus 6 scaled to a kilohertz. Okay? So again, this angle is really tiny compared to that angle. Omega and J are almost lined up. Okay. So what's the precession rate phi dot? Well, the quick way of doing it is the following. It's a little tricky. So phi dot, again, is the precession rate. It's the rate at which nd rotates around j. Okay. Again, I should have said that nd, and this nice last time, this is the great thing about this model, is nd, omega, and j are all coplanar. The only thing that can happen is it rotates around J. And so we get almost exactly the same picture as, this is the great thing, as in the rigid case. The angles are a little different, but the picture's the same. The whole thing just goes like this. Okay? Okay. So let J be along the Z direction, and this direction in the board be X. Then I can rewrite omega in terms of J and X, and N in terms of J and X, and then I can just re-eliminate X, okay, to write omega in terms of J and N, okay, and then I see that omega is a piece, has a piece along N and a piece along J, okay. So the question is, the question I want to know the answer to is, how fast is ND going around J? And the way I do it is I rewrite omega, which is the way, which is tells you how N is moving. That's the spin frequency. Omega really is the spin frequency. Well, the piece that keeps N completely fixed, so this one doesn't matter for how N is moving. And then it has a piece around J, which is exactly tells me what I want. And then a little algebra, so it just tells me that the precession frequency is omega, spin frequency, has 1 plus this, again, this tiny correction factor, theta hat over theta, plus wobble squared corrections, plus higher order terms. Okay? So it's 1 plus this tiny number. Okay? Where this was a tiny number I worked out before if I scale it to 100 hertz, it's 2 times 10 to the minus 8. Okay? So it's wobbling just a little faster than it's processing. It's processing just a little faster than it's spinning. Typically. Okay, now I'm going to tell you how I derive the damping rate. Okay, this is not how Bertrandian and Neeley derived it, but it's easy. This is a one page. Okay, so I know it was correct. So, you know, let's just, you can work out, so it's just using energy and angular momentum conservation. The other derivation was this complicated adding of torques and things. I'm just going to use energy and angular momentum conservation. Okay, you can show for the elastic case, you can just expand the energy of the wobbling motion. Okay? And you can just show that there are certain, you can expand it in theta and j. There's some expansion parameter. And I claim you can show on general grounds, it just has to have some form like this plus higher order terms. It can't be any, you can think of it, so there are no linear terms in j. It has to be quadratic, so it's a quadratic. It can't be any cubic terms. Can't be any linear terms in theta. It just has to have an expansion like this. Some expansion with zero wobble, zero theta, and zero spin, and then this kind of expansion, okay? And you can, if just a little bit of work, I'm not going to show you just a couple lines, you can show actually what this d coefficient has to be. It's how the energy changes if it's not exactly aligned, if n isn't exactly aligned with the j. And D you can just work out using formula on the previous page is proportional to delta ID over the moment of inertia squared. This is S is the spherical star, the non-spinning star. Okay? If delta D were zero, you couldn't even tell what theta was. So it's pretty clear it has to be something like that. Okay? Okay. And now I'm going to write E dot, the change in time, the time derivative of the energy, is just dEdj times j dot plus dEd theta times theta dot. Simple. And you can rearrange this, of course, to say that let me just rewrite it over here. It makes it a little easier. I should have done that before. So then theta dot is just then E dot minus dEdj j dot over dEd theta. Okay. So this is what I want to know. This is the time change of the wobble angle. And I just have to know E dot, dEdj and dEd theta. Okay? J dot, okay, so what are these terms? So one thing I know is that E dot always has to be J dot times phi dot. So why is the thing losing energy? It's losing energy because it's losing the gravitational radiation. And it's m equals one radiation. Every graviton, if you wish, if you want to think of it in terms of quantum mechanics, takes away the precession frequencies, h bar times precession frequency of energy, and m equals one, and h bar of angular momentum. So the ratio of E dot to J dot is just this for the frequency of the radiation. That's just a general result. Okay? The menu you could put classically, that I like to think of it quantum mechanically, but it always has to be true. Okay? So here I can just write this thing as J dot phi dot. So nice, notice I have J dot and phi dot, okay? What's the EDJ? Well, here there's just a nice theorem, actually, that, so for first, the EDJ, really you want a constant theta, but that will be the EDJ at theta equals zero plus terms of order theta squared. Just remember that and calculate this piece for now. We'll eventually see these we can just ignore for small wobble angle. Okay, so what's the EDJ as you spin up a star? This is just a famous theorem from stellar structure, if you want. You can find in famous classic books that the EDJ for an axisymmetric rotating star is always just the spin frequency. Okay? Trust me if you don't believe. You can find it in old textbooks. It's a standard well-known result. Okay? Okay, so this thing then is J dot times phi dot minus omega over d e d theta. Okay. Great. But what's this? This is just the. So this is the, again, the precession frequency minus the spin frequency. It's the small number I'm talking about, right? It's the body frame precession frequency. And dE d theta, well, that's easy. dE d theta is d theta j squared, and d, where d is this thing. Okay? So dE d theta is this. Okay? I think... I guess that's right. Okay. And now I've got all the terms in here, and I know what dE theta is, and I know what, and J dot is just something I can calculate. I calculate the quadrant, so I have this motion, this precessional motion. From that I calculate the time derivatives of all the quadrupole moments. I calculate the rate at which energy is radiated, and that's J dot. Okay? So I calculate all these things, and then let's put it together. And I get that theta dot is minus 2/5 G over C to the 5th delta I D squared over I naught S phi dot to the 4th, and phi dot's almost omega to the 4th, times theta. So this is 1 over the gravity wave damping time scale. It's really just a page. Plus, well, it's a little more than a page because you have to work out what J dot is. Okay? But it's very simple. It also falls out just from energy and angular momentum conservation. And the thing that's really robust about the sign, notice that it's proportional. What keeps the sign correct is that both dE d theta, this is proportional to delta ID. And this is also proportional to delta ID. So if the thing were prolate in terms of instead of oblate, the sign of this would flip. But the sign of this flips as well. And that's the thing that always keeps it the same sign. And that's what I think is very robust about here. So the thing damps for oblate motion because precession frequency is bigger than spin frequency. And that's really the only thing it depends on. Is the fact, and I think that's very robust. As long as it's precessing, as long as its shape is a little oblate, that makes this, sets the sign of this, and as long as that means that it's precessing faster than it's spinning a little bit, then it always damps and these can't change too much, I believe. So I think it's very robust from this point of view. Yes?
When you say, and then you have to calculate J dot, do you do that by calculating E dot using the quadrupole formula, using E dot as J dot phi dot? Or
yes, that's right. No, that's the easiest way, so let's do it that way.
Kurt, if you neglect this memory bulge that the ID that the star has, say it's perfectly rigid and put a mountain on it.
Yeah, the formula is still...
The
formula is still completely correct. I explained it the way I did because I think it's the more usual case, probably, and because I think it's the best way of giving feeling, but the formula is completely correct. It doesn't depend on how the bulge was created. It doesn't depend on that at all. Okay, so that's the answer. Now I'll just tell you where Bacardi and Anneli went wrong, okay? Am I out of time? I haven't paid much attention.
People are fading. So
okay.
You can do it in 5 minutes.
Okay, fine.
See who's present before we go to lunch.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. So I told you, roughly speaking, what Bertrand and Euler failed to do, that they did the same, they took the Euler equations essentially. They get something like the Euler equations for the elastic body. And they did what they did before, was they calculated the radiation reaction torque from the Birkthorne potential, and they just followed the same calculation line by line by line. And that's what Ian Jones did, blah, 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 blah. But what they forgot 27 years ago was that this radiation reaction potential, it's not a rigid body anymore. The radiation reaction potential acts like a real potential and actually changes the shape of the body. So there are two kinds of terms to add, a torque term and a delta I term. And it turns out that those two terms cancel very exquisitely to about 1 part in 10 to the fifth. Okay, you can work out exactly the change of shape of the body due to the radiation reaction potential, and it almost exactly cancels the other term. You can ask, how can you possibly do that? That's, I think, the surprising thing. You should say, how do you know how this funny radiation reaction potential changes the shape of the body? But the wonderful thing is, as I realized on the bus, was that the radiation reaction potential has this very special property that it grows quadratically with distance. From the, it's just some simple tensor, like the fifth time derivative of the inertia tensor, times xx. Okay? So it grows exactly like the centrifugal potential. So you've already parameterized that the centrifugal force changes the shape of the body. That's in your delta I omega. That's the only constant you need. You know how the body changes from when you add some quadratic potential. And then from symmetry consideration, you know exactly how it changes from this radiation reaction potential. So you just calculate the change in shape. And then you find out that it's this. Okay? And it almost exactly cancels that with a little bit of leftover piece. And a little bit of leftover piece is exactly what I gave you before. Okay? So that's the answer. And so, 2 more minutes, okay? And so for an elastic star, the answer is gravity waves always damp neutron star oscillations with a long time scale. And now the final little thing is, and this thesis didn't include superfluids at all. Or not much. And I don't think he actually understood when he was writing a thesis that popular wisdom is that pin superfluids can really affect precession a lot. I didn't understand that until 2 days ago, when I was 3 days ago when I was preparing this talk and reading up on recent stuff. As Ben told yesterday, unfortunately, this last example, if the thing is precessing 1828, if it is precessing, then it can't be pin superfluid. But let's just ask ourselves how pin superfluid would change things. Okay? And this is all work done at Burger King 2 days ago.
So what is the damping time for that, the gravity wave damping time for this pulsar?
Okay, so the summary.
What's the number?
Right. So, can I say that a little differently? Okay. For this gravity wave damping time for this pulsar, assuming it's not pinned, it'd be some huge number, like 10 to 12 years or something.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly, but it'd be something.
Whereas it would have been 100 years.
Something like that.
Okay.
No, 10 to minus 5, actually. It still would have been long, because it's such a slowly, it's spinning so slowly, it's always small. So here, just a summary. So this is the rigid body result. Things proportional 1 over delta I squared. What Bertotti and Neeley found is proportional incorrectly to 1 over delta I omega times 1 over delta I d. Notice this doesn't have a definite sign. And I just said, no, that delta, we found this delta I omega should be another delta I d. And that's a factor of 10 to the 5. Okay, that's the summary. And then I just talked about elastic, whole thing being elastic. And so you can also then redo a little bit more and say you have an elastic crust with a normal fluid interior, not a superfluid interior. And that just changes that I to the I of the crust. Other calculations. Superfluids change the, if they're pinned superfluids, it changes everything a great deal. I only found that out recently. You can still do almost everything I did. You can just redo it actually in an hour, I think. So you can do it in an hour and then check it in 3 days, you know, making sure you didn't do anything wrong. But the idea with a pinned superfluid is actually remembers this end direction a lot better than you ever would have gotten just from shear strains in the crust. The claim is, if a superfluid is really pinned, then the angular velocity of the pinned superfluid just is always completely aligned with this print, with this axis, this preferred axis of the crust, and always follows that. So there's a large piece that follows the preferred axis a large piece of moment inertia always follows the preferred axis if you have a pin superfluid, which can't be the case in this example, but imagine if you did have a pin superfluid. So then again, you can just work out, it's still true, that phi dot for example is omega times 1 plus this ratio of angles, theta hat over theta. But now theta hat over theta is large, it's like 1%, not 10 to the minus 8. So you get a body frame precession frequency that's down by, you know, that's just 100 times longer than the not 10 to the 8th times longer, right? And what I think, that's certainly true, I think you'd agree. And then what I worked out just the other day is the only thing that changes that other formula is now the I, instead of using delta ID, that just gets replaced by the moment of inertia of the pin superfluid, which would give you a damping time of like 5 times 10 to the 4 seconds for gravity waves for fast spinning neutron stars. So it would be a pretty fast damper again, pretty fast, if you had pin superfluid. But that can't be the case here of 1828 that Bennett talks about, because then it would take, then the wobble frequency, the body frame wobble frequency would be a lot higher. So that's what I think the story is for pin superfluid. And now I'm done. Okay, I'm sorry I took too long.
What sort of precession frequency does delta ID give?
You mean inertial frame or body frame? So inertial, as I said.
What about body frame?
The body frame, it's always true that...
No, my question is, what is it numerically? Because...
For which object?
You said delta, any object you want. Why don't we take 1828? The spin period is 0.4 seconds.
So it's about right. It's about right. So I worked this out. So delta ID in this case is over I for this process is something on the order of 10 to the minus 8. You can work it out. It's actually a little bit, so it's a little smaller than that. So to make it work for 1828, the story with no pin superfluid, what you have to assume is it started out spinning not at 1 point, not at half a second, but something like a tenth of a second or something, and hasn't cracked since as it slowed down. It's kept its residual oblateness from a slightly larger spin period, but it's certainly in the ballpark. It was spinning a few times faster, and then you get everything right. Yeah.
So, if you had started trying to analyze this, as a star with modes.
Yeah, sure. That's right.
You would have found, presumably, the CFS instability. So, I guess the question that I have is, what assumptions have changed that lead to damping in this case, whereas in the other case, you might have assumed you would have found instability.
Why do you mean? It would be a completely different mode, though.
Well, presumably there is a mode that corresponds to.
Sure.
This wobble.
Yeah.
And there's some instability that must be present. So. Have you just eliminated it by focusing on this particular form for the wobble? Doesn't include any of the unstable modes.
Sure, absolutely. I look at one kind of motion. I guess there'll be other, just like if you look at, how I focused on G modes and a neutron star, that's right. And I show that they're all stable. That doesn't mean there's not some unstable F mode. That's a different kind of mode. I've looked at one kind of, I haven't looked at the most general possible motion of the whole thing. I've looked at one kind of motion, like one excited mode, and said, what happens over time? And that excited mode damps. Yeah.
I don't think that this affects the calculation you did, because it looks like the only thing that you need to calculate for gravitational radiation is E dot. But I was wondering about the radiation reaction potential.
Yeah.
Because on the face of it, it doesn't look agent variable.
Yeah.
So, why is it that we're supposed to trust results that we get from it?
That's a good question. So I'll be completely honest and say that if I had just derived this result from the radiation interaction potential, because it's not quite gauge invariant, I wouldn't quite believe it. And when I was sitting on the bus wondering what was wrong with Ian Jones's calculation, one of my things I was thinking of was, maybe this is some case where just some funny thing is happening with the radiation interaction potential, and you just can't really trust it in this case for some reason. But it turns out if you just use it blindly and assume it's right and get the right dynamics, you get the same answer as this much more robust calculation. So I do think of it as extra evidence for the robust calculation. But it's true that the CFS and the radiation interaction potential is something I don't completely understand, because I actually have in my back pocket one example where I know, in fact, if you just do the completely naive thing with the radiation interaction potential, it actually gives the wrong answer. So there's some cases where I know you can't believe it, but most cases it somehow gives the right answer. And I'd like to sort out someday when you can completely trust it. I don't know the answer to that. So I believe the answer because of the robust calculation.
All right, so tomorrow, the meeting of Ben and Sock will actually not be in this room because they have to prepare this for the party. So we'll do it in the founder's room, and there'll be a few graphs set up. Okay, so it'll be in the...
Okay.
We'll have extra chairs.
Use a notebook computer, so we'll just need the...
So just so you know, it'll be in the founder's room.
Okay.
Great, thanks, Kurt.
Thank you.